Hello again, everybody. It's Mitchell Warren from AVAC, and delighted to welcome you all to this call. That is in a long tradition of webinars to follow major conferences, to have a chance to talk about what was discussed, what was presented, what wasn't presented but was discussed, and what made headlines. Just to give you a little bit of logistic for the call, we do have it in a global mute just to keep the line clear as we are recording it, and it will be posted on the website after the call for people who aren't able to join to follow along. I'm going to do a very brief introduction to the conference and present a few just top-line headlines to give everyone a sense of where the conference news was circulating, at least in the public face. I'm delighted to welcome four colleagues from different parts of the world and different parts of the AIDS response to provide their perspectives on the call, or on the webinar itself. And then we will open it up to questions and comments. I know there are others of you on the line who were in Vancouver, and we certainly want to hear from you. And I know that most of you on the line weren't in Vancouver and really want to make sure you have a chance to hear from those who were in terms of finding out what was discussed and presented in the midst of the conference. And then we do want to spend a little time at the end, or as much time as people would like, to think about what happens between now, as we sit here in July 2015, and thinking ahead to July 2016, when many more people will gather at the International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa, a rather monumental event we all expect. So thank you all. I do want to say at any point, you can put questions in the chat box, and we will get to those in the queue. You can also email them to avac@avac.org, and we'll certainly be opening the line, and I'll give you some instructions on how to do that, to unmute your line to ask the questions, and then hopefully to mute your line to keep the line clear. And as I say, we do have a number of resource people who I will introduce in just a couple of minutes to give their perspectives, and then we'll open it up. But I did want to begin with what I think we're now seeing more and more in the age of social media and the internet, but a fairly classic word cloud. And this represents a fairly selective case. For those of you who have passed AVAC webinars and some of the conversations before the IAS meeting in Vancouver, obviously we were looking forward to a lot of information about the START trial, about various PrEP trials being presented. And this certainly is not comprehensive, but it does take a look at news stories and headlines that emerged out of Vancouver. It is not reflecting everything, but I think it does give you a very interesting sense of where the news was and where the conversation gravitated. Certainly treatment and PrEP clearly there early, as you see in the top, reflecting a really terrific section around the START data, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit. A research-based conference, of course, so study comes up quite prominently. But I think just interesting look at some of the major themes, young women in the top right, people at high risk just below the word PrEP. But a really interesting depiction, I think, in terms of where the conversations were gravitating. And I do want to spend just a couple of minutes looking just some real top-line headlines. And again, a selective sense of where the news was coming from during the course of the conference. And again, you can see a lot around treatment and prevention. But in the very top left, you'll see an important headline, which I will talk about. A French teenager in remission for 12 years reported out at the conference. A number of pre-demonstration projects and other studies looking dosing, looking at adherence, and I think a really interesting amount of conversations we have. And I should also say that Richard Jeffries from the Treatment Action Group is on the line, and I think might talk a bit about the French teenager. Nelly Mugo from Kenya, who's led pioneering work around PrEP in women, will hopefully address some of those issues related to PrEP. you'll see at the bottom a headline about cash compensation. And there was a fantastic session, and I'm delighted Audrey Pettifor from the University of North Carolina, who led one of the major studies presented in that session from the HIV Prevention Trials Network, really creating a lot of important conversations about the role of compensation and incentives. Very importantly, right in the midst of the conference and in the middle of this slide, you see WHO and UNAIDS, the talk of planning to end AIDS with new testing guidelines. And on Sunday, they did announce the new WHO guidelines related to testing, and we'll certainly talk about that. And let me just go to the next slide then. And again, more headlines. A big conversation you'll see in that top left about will women take oral PrEP? And I think important data coming from a number of studies, which we can talk about. Right in the middle, you'll see the HIV Discover. That's, of course, Françoise Barrès-Sinoussi, the Nobel Prize winner and former president of the International AIDS Society, who was quoted in a CNN interview, to develop a cure is almost impossible. But I think importantly, the article goes on to say what important work is happening in the research world and why that is so important. And we'll talk a bit more about that. And at the very bottom, activists worldwide call for immediate HIV treatment. Again, coming out of the START data and a session just last Monday where a large amount of data was presented, really exciting and important, I think, to think about what will come next with WHO guidelines. And then you'll see in the very top right, World Health Organization to recommend early treatment for everyone with HIV. And we can spend a little time talking about the WHO guidelines. As I say, they did present testing guidelines in Vancouver, and they did mention several times that they will be soon presenting updated treatment and prevention guidelines with antiretrovirals, which we can talk a bit about. Again, this is just two slides worth of headlines from what we think of as the traditional media. But of course, as I think everybody on this call will know, so much more happens than in the traditional media. This is just a single slide showing some tweets that emanated from a number of different organizations. And again, if you do go, and I think people were really quite diligent across the community to use the hashtag IAS2015. And if you search for that on Twitter, you really can get a sense of where the conversations were about specific studies and that the HPTN reported. Just as the conference session around the START data was presented, the New England Journal of Medicine published both the actual study results as well as a terrific commentary from Slim Abdul-Karim talking about the START data and their implications. So again, a really interesting sense of where some of the conversation was emanating. That is just a very brief summary looking at both traditional media headlines as well as some of the Twitter feeds. What we really then wanted to do was to open this up to have some of wonderful research and advocacy colleagues reflect a bit on their own experiences in Vancouver, what they saw as overriding messages and their takeaways as they reflected on last week and as they think ahead to the future. Just to give you a sense, and I mentioned a few people already, Nelly Mugo from Kenya is on the line, Richard Jeffries from the Treatment Action Group, Audrey Pettifor from the University of North Carolina, and I'll turn to them in just a moment. But I want to start with a great friend and ally, Owen Ryan, who, as you will all know, about a year ago took up the role as the executive director of the International AIDS Society and started just before the AIDS conference in Melbourne in 2014, a very poignant time and a very important remembrance, I think, just to say up front that that conference obviously started at a very difficult moment and with the tragedy of the Malaysian airline. There was a wonderful tribute to
all those who perished, but also a special session with a special lecture in memory of Yublanga, who was such a huge figure in the field. But Owen began as the head of IAS in the midst of that, and this IAS meeting in Vancouver was a year into the job, and I thought it might be helpful to start with you, Owen. You can hit *7 to unmute your line. To give a perspective from the IAS and with any reflections you might have about the conference.
Thanks, Mitchell. Can you hear me okay?
I can indeed.
Great. Thank you for having me on the call, and I really appreciate your kind words and the consistent support of AVAC for the IAS and our conferences. I think no one is more active on Twitter or following around on social media than you guys, and it's really nice to kind of see the conversation you guys start. So I just kind of taking your cue, I just had two kind of really quick points. You know, I think for a lot of folks there was this kind of feeling that something about the conference in Vancouver was different. And for me that was kind of along two lines. One was that, you know, we had very deliberately packed the program to the gills. So we had the highest scoring abstracts for any IAS conference ever. And as a result, we had 20% more content. So it was interesting that, you know, you saw people at the conference center until late at night, kind of in workshops and different sessions. And it was interesting to see kind of not only how tired people were, but how much people were eager to kind of fill in their schedule. One of the others was this sense of what I keep calling the Vancouver story, and Mitchell, you've been really good at telling this narrative. You know, I don't think it was lost on anyone there that the last time a conference had been in Vancouver was 1996, which had really been the big breakthrough of triple drug therapy. And kind of moving forward to 2015 and having UNAIDS just a week or two beforehand announce the milestone achievement of 15 million people on treatment, and then that doubled up with the results from the start. It really was this kind of unbelievable narrative that sometimes I think we can take for granted around kind of the power of HIV treatment and how much we've been able to change the epidemic in our lifetime. There's no question that there's a lot of work left to do, but I think there was this real reflection moment for people that, you know, sometimes we're not always great at celebrating our victories, and kind of where we've come so far is pretty remarkable and not seen in a lot of other areas. So there was a real sense of the only parallel I can draw is for folks who were at the conference in Vienna and went to the Caprisa 006 session. So sitting in the start section, you could really feel this sense of history there. The room was overcrowded and hot, and everybody was really anticipating what some of us kind of already knew, but was nonetheless nice to hear confirmed. And you know, as Chris, the president of the IAS, said early on, you know, the START data, even if it confirmed what we knew, it really moved when to start treatment from kind of a science question to a finance and political will question. And that's an important milestone for all of us. I think we're able to move past the back and forth on the policy and guidelines piece, even as we wait for the WHO. To really focus on, no, this is about getting the politicians and the money to fund this, which was kind of a nice turn. And as many people have seen, the Vancouver consensus that has come out since then with a lot of the world's leaders and researchers and advocates signing on to call for this immediate funding of the next 15, 16 million people on treatment. The only other piece for me before we jump into Durban later in the conversation is a little plug for the IAS. You know, we have been in a process now for the last year of trying to kind of recognize our faults and address them quickly. And one thing a lot of people have said over the past year is, you know, hey, my membership is really just something I tick as I go to a conference. And this is something me and the team are really working hard to address. So we have a lot of things that we'll be rolling out over the next 6 months, but one thing I would love people on the phone call to do, if you agree with that sentiment at all and are interested in changing the IAS, we're in the process of running a survey now that is going to help develop our strategy, and that is at iasociety.org/strategy. So thanks, Mitchell, for the five-second plug.
No problem. Thank you, Owen. And I'm sure we'll come back to that, and people are welcome to make some comments and questions about the IAS overall. So thank you so much. Let me next see, Nellie, are you on the line? If you hit *7, hopefully you'll unmute yourself. Nellie? All right, we will see if we can get Nellie either unmuted or back on the line. Maybe I'll turn to Audrey Pettifor. Audrey, are you on?
Can you hear me?
I can. So wonderful, Audrey. Thank you. And just to say again, Audrey is from the University of North Carolina and has led a really pioneering study that was reported out at the conference from the HIV Prevention Trials Network. And I'm happy to have you reflect on the whole conference, but would love particularly your sense of the conversation in that session that you did, where you presented the final results from the study.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Mitchell. So, I agree with the sentiments. I think this definitely was a conference about the power of treatment, and I think that's really exciting. I think for someone who's worked in prevention for young women in sub-Saharan Africa for many years, I see optimism and I see the glimmer that PrEP holds for prevention, and yet I guess it was disappointing in that both the HPTN-068 trial that we led, which was a large conditional cash transfer with high school girls in South Africa, where they were provided monthly stipends conditioned on attending school, we did not see any difference in HIV incidence in those getting the cash and those that did not. And also the CAPRISA group, Karisha Abdul Karim, also with high school kids, boys and girls, providing cash for a number of different sort of HIV prevention-related activities, also did not see any impact on HIV, although they did see an impact on HSV2. And so I think just a little bit of a, there's been a lot of momentum around cash transfers, particularly from some of the observational work and from some of the World Bank studies suggesting that, cash transfers really held a lot of promise for prevention. And I think, everyone was really hoping that these two studies would kind of knock it out of the park and, just confirm, yes, cash can prevent infections in young women. And unfortunately, I think it brought us back to the drawing board to say, okay, this is more complicated than we would like. I think from our 068 study, a really important finding, we started this study because we did a large survey in South Africa of young people in 2003. And really the strongest finding from that survey was that girls who did not complete high school were at significantly increased risk of HIV infection. And so we started looking at interventions to help girls stay in school, recognizing from a global literature that there's a lot of financial and other barriers to young women staying in high school as they age and particularly completing high school. And that's kind of where we started this from. So what we did see was that, unexpectedly, 95% of girls in this study who were high school girls, stayed in school in both arms. So they did not need the cash transfer to stay in school, which was surprising. But girls who stayed in school were at reduced risk of HIV infection. So girls who didn't attend 80% of the time and girls who dropped out were three times more likely to acquire HIV during the trial. So I do think the message of keeping girls in school came out, and although, it wasn't a randomized trial to do that, and I don't think we can do a randomized trial about keeping kids in school per se other than through this means, I think that message remains. I think the challenge is still where does cash fit, and I think from a number of studies, so Harsha Thurumanthi's study in Kenya looking at incentives for men to get circumcised, Marcel Yotibiang did a study in the DRC around incentives for women to attend their ANC, their PMPCT visits, showing that that worked. So I think there's a sense that incentives can do things like get people to test or can get people to get, to come for circumcision or perhaps to come for their ANC visits. So there's certainly a sense that it can get people into services, and I think there are questions about, can we use this for example, PrEP adherence. The 065 trial, HPTN, that Wafa El-Sadr led was not great in terms of giving us evidence that cash could improve linkage to care or adherence, but I think there is a question about where cash fits, and for prevention, I think it's more complicated, and I'll stop and we can talk more or take questions, but I think as we think forward to Durban and where this agenda goes now, I think we need to think a little bit harder about how we combine cash with other prevention modalities like PrEP. I do think we need, in our excitement about treatment, I don't want us to lose sight of the harder, not that treatment's not hard, but some of the bigger structural issues like gender-based violence and poverty that we know came out from things like the VOICE trial and ThumbPrep as barriers for women in terms of, being able to implement prevention. So they're hard and we don't have a lot of clean answers for what to do about that, and I do feel like we need to work harder around those areas.
great. Audrey, thank you so much. And I think this issue of where does cash fit and where does it fit within the sense of combination prevention, and where does combination prevention fit and link with treatment in a truly comprehensive way. The good news is, I think, in that word cloud showed that although treatment was so much at the center, rightly, because of the START data and new enthusiasm, happily the conference didn't make it seem like treatment was the only answer, but the challenge of prevention remains. So really appreciate you putting all of that into context. I know Nellie is there. Let me try again for Nellie, because it's a perfect segue into talking about prevention and some of the PrEP conversations. So Nellie, why don't you try again, and also you might want to hit *7 on your phone and see if that gets you off of mute.
Hi.
Oh, hello, this is Nellie. Wonderful.
Great. So
fantastic.
There's a lot of yes. Hi, everybody. There's a lot of very positive energy and reports on pre-exposure prophylaxis, given that the initial trials, you know, had the discordant couples trials, the MSM trials, and heterosexuals in Botswana showing evidence of efficacy, and then we had the challenge of the young women in VOICE and FemPrep. But actually, from demonstration projects, it looks like this challenge doesn't really exist. And we had several sessions, and the data from demonstration projects that were shown, some from Brazil, and seemed to show much higher effectiveness now that people know that the product works. So that was very encouraging. On the last day on Wednesday, actually, Qureshi Abdul Karim also presented on a case study and also of a young woman in South Africa and her need for PrEP, and showed us some data on the segregated, where women actually took product in the other trials, and there's evidence of efficacy, so that we can move away from the conversation that PrEP doesn't work for young women. The other big part is that the World Health Organization is working on guidelines for pre-exposure prophylaxis that is no longer limited to MSMs and discordant couples, which is also encouraging, so that it opens up that agenda to allow other people to use PrEP. Another presentation from Bob Grant looked at hepatitis B and the question of flare-up, and they tested and retested for Hep B and did not have evidence for flare-up from the small sample. So that was very, very encouraging reporting. So I think the energy and the momentum from this conference for pre-exposure prophylaxis has switched to being more positive towards where do we move to implementation now. I think that's the momentum. How do we provide this product so that those people who need it will have access? And there was another session with WHO also discussing issues of pre-exposure prophylaxis to a group which wasn't in the trials, and that's adolescent girls. And that was also an encouraging discussion.
Great. Nellie, thank you so much. And I know we're going to come back to this, and a number of questions have already come in, which we'll come to in just a moment. But that's a wonderful setup. And also, I wanted just to mention, and I know there are people on the line who can speak to it as well, that the conversation was much more robust and interesting, both with PrEP and women in Africa, but also some really interesting conversations about PrEP in the U.S. context as well, both some huge steps forward, but also some highlighting of some of the challenges there, which I hope we can come to. So a wonderful setup. Before we open it up to all the questions and conversations, let me turn to Richard Jeffries, who runs one of the most informative and interesting blogs related to tracking the science through the Treatment Action Group. But Richard, I wonder if you wanted to provide a bit of insight from your perspective.
Sure thing, Mitchell. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Excellent. So thanks for the introduction and for inviting me on the call. I think one thing that's notable is that the IAS remains sort of committed to being leaders on the cure research front. And so there was a symposium immediately ahead of the main conference called the Towards an HIV Cure Symposium. They held the first one in 2010, and then it's been happening every year since 2012. And so if you search online for IAS Towards an HIV Cure, you'll find the information on the symposium. Pretty much all the presentations are up there now. I think there's going to be audio as well. And one of the big stories that you mentioned at the beginning that came out of the conference was presented on Sunday at that symposium by Asia Sirion from the Pasteur Institute. And it was about the case of a teenager who's been off antiretroviral therapy for around 12 years now and seems to be controlling viral load to undetectable levels. And so that's been described as a case of remission. And there's a lot of publicity around it. Unfortunately, there's sort of a lot of complexity behind the story that doesn't necessarily come out in the media. I mean, what specifically happened is that the child had been started on antiretroviral therapy within 6 months of birth, had been perinatally infected, had been on treatment till around age six, and then lost a follow-up for a year. And when they came back into care, antiretroviral therapy had been stopped, but the viral load remained under control. And there's been a couple of small blips to around 500 copies, but for most of the rest of the time, it's been undetectable. And so there's hope that maybe something can be learned from cases like this in terms of achieving some kind of remission from infection. Some of the unknowns that are important, though, I think one thing to stress is that there has been a lot of studies of early treated infants where interruptions have been conducted, and in the vast majority of cases, there's viral load rebound and CD4 decline, and so that's why this isn't something that happens very often where treatment is interrupted. The other issue is that it's known from some other examples of what appears to be natural control of HIV, that the immune system having to work to control the infection can actually have something of a cost to both the integrity of the immune system, to the lymph tissues, and perhaps to health as well. And so, although it may seem strange to say, it's actually not really certain that, you know, the 12 years without therapy, that the long-term consequences of that, or whether it's equal to having been on antiretroviral therapy or whether suppression from antiretroviral therapy would actually be better. And so that's something that's kind of unclear at the moment, and there needs to be more work done. And that's something that I think is an intense focus for future research. And I think, you know, it's something that the IS is continuing to support, and so we will see a lot more data along these lines. And that's probably the main issue. There was some encouraging news also on the vaccine front, just so that we don't forget that. There's a couple of really good presentations that people can download, one by Tony Fauci and the other by Glenda Gray, a couple of big efforts going on now to push vaccines toward efficacy trials, and some encouraging data that it may be possible to achieve a significant amount of protection with vaccines. But I think I'll stop there and so we can get to the questions.
Great. Richard, thank you so much. I do want to say, and one of the things you said at the very end reminded me, that the plenaries in each day, of course, started with a set of three or four plenaries, were really an outstanding collection of presentations, including Glenda Gritt from Wednesday morning. Nicolas Chaman did, I thought, one of the clearest overviews of the CURE research agenda earlier in the conference. Trip Gulick did a really terrific overview of the antiretroviral therapy landscape over the last 20 years, and all of those and other of the plenaries are all on the IIS website with, I believe it's all available, and Owen, you can correct me, but I believe both the slides and the actual webcast of their presentations, I believe, are online, and we can make sure that the follow-up to this webinar email includes those links, but really a great way to get an overview sense of all the major themes in the conference. And then Tony Fauci, as Richard said, did a special lecture in the middle of the day on Monday, and again, I'm pretty sure that is webcast, which really pulls a lot of these pieces together. So just to confirm, Owen, is that correct that all of these slides and presentations are available on the website still?
Oh. Yes, they are. Oh, sorry, Mitchell.
No problem. Great. So wonderful. So really appreciate all four of your perspectives. A number of questions have come in. Maybe what I'll do is spend a few minutes going through some of the questions that have come in, both those before the conference as well as before the call, as well as those that have come in while you four spoke. And one particular one to you, Audrey, which I think is really interesting, and it relates also to one of the other plenaries in first part of the conference on Monday. Debbie Burks, ambassador and head of the PEPFAR program, did an overview of the entire PEPFAR program, but mentioned the DREAMS initiative, a major intervention in 10 countries focused on young women, which include support for cash transfer programs. And a terrific question from a colleague in Kenya. What does your finding and the conversation about cash transfers might mean for immediate support in the PEPFAR DREAMS program? And also, UNAIDS has used cash transfers as part of their 90-90-90 modeling to end the epidemic, and wondering if you have a sense of where your findings kind of fit in that discussion now.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Someone came up to me as well from Tanzania about DREAMS, and clearly I think these two studies, CAPRISA and HPTN-068, add to the complexity of what we, you know, what role cash transfers have for prevention. I think as I said last week, and I'll say often, is that I think you really need to know your context, you know, and what are you trying to achieve with the cash. So again, I think we kind of break it down, and I think UNICEF and others, into, you know, a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa have these large social protection programs for poverty alleviation, and I think those are important and those are in place, and they target the most vulnerable, and they've been shown to have a lot of positive impacts, you know, including keeping girls in school and, you know, increasing food security in homes. Certainly, Lucy Kluver's data from South Africa, which was observational, seemed to suggest that the Child Support Grant, which is one of these big social protection programs, could, you know, change sexual behaviors. In 068, we saw there were significant changes in some sexual behaviors, but not in incidence. So that always makes it difficult. But so, I mean, I think there's a couple of ways to go. I think people can say, okay, we think we should use cash transfers to, you know, get hard-to-reach groups to test, or perhaps to get, you know, young women to come into the clinic or to adhere to PrEP. Or I think there's some good evidence that, you know, using cash incentives for these specific service-related objectives work really well. I think when we're thinking about cash to maybe defer transactional sex or to help young women kind of get out of poverty and therefore, you know, make safer sexual choices, the evidence is more complex. And our data certainly, you know, doesn't shine a lot of light on that. So hopefully we'll be getting more information as we do more analysis. But I think what we need are perhaps demonstration projects or in the DREAMS initiative where people are looking at, okay, if we provide cash with some kind of financial education and training and HIV prevention education, what happens? Because the studies to date have been just sort of, here's the cash, does it prevent infection? And it's not in the context of a larger prevention program. So I do think that there's room in different contexts to look at providing cash to young women combined with other, you know, whether it's skills-based prevention or empowerment programs or financial education. I think, you know, we haven't looked at that, and I think that's an area where, you know, there's some suggestion that we might need to combine cash with other things if we're looking at more than linkage to services. That would be sort of my current thinking right now based on what we know.
That's terrific, Audrey. One other follow-on question from the line was, are you aware of other studies specifically looking at cash transfers that are still in the field that might answer additional questions? Or is this an area that needs kind of newly designed operational work, maybe in you know, integrated into DREAMS or other initiatives?
Yeah, to my knowledge, the CAPRISA and PTM were the two large trials with incidence endpoints in young women. I'm not aware of other big studies. There clearly are what you might call implementation science. So I believe that that Connie Kellum and Linda Gail Becker have a small pilot study looking at cash plus PrEP in Cape Town that they're doing. And so that's something to be thinking about. And I think Lucy Kluver might be doing some work in South Africa looking at for HIV-infected adolescents, again, sort of cash around adherence and staying in care. So I think there are smaller studies going on. You know, I'm not aware of any large trials at this point looking at sort of incidence, and I'm not sure if that is where we need to be going with the field, or if we need to be looking, you know, at more of these kind of uptake of services and retention and care. I think so I'm not aware of other big studies, but if other people know of them, please let us know.
That's terrific. And so I think a really clear call that this is far more complex than simply putting it into a modeling exercise to say cash transfers can do X, or to assume that cash transfers mean one particular thing. I think the complexity you're describing is a really important takeaway than how we integrate it into other programs. You mentioned the link potentially with cash transfers. And a number of questions came in, Nellie, as you were speaking, and you alluded to some of this, but, you know, interestingly, there was a question from someone who said, or a comment from someone on the line who said, it seems like oral PrEP really among women is feasible, whereas perhaps in the past people thought it wasn't feasible. And yet someone else wrote in and said, you know, there was a lot of chatter at the conference from some quarters of people saying, you know, oh, well, PrEP doesn't work for women. And wonder if you, Nellie, might be able to kind of give your, you know, what are you saying as both an advocate and as a researcher about PrEP in women based on the evidence that we've had coming in over the last many, many months, and including what was presented in Vancouver. So what are you saying when people say, what about PrEP in women?
Hi again. You know that statement that PrEP doesn't work in women implies a biological action. But actually, we have to recognize that even from our own studies, the serodiscordant couple studies, those were women. And, you know, just because they have a relationship with an HIV-infected man doesn't mean that physiologically or biologically their susceptibility to HIV is different. It's just that their partner is known. I think every transmission event is between somebody with infection and without infection. So I think, and the additional data that has come up from the trials which did not show efficacy have clearly demonstrated that the product wasn't taken. And, you know, we all know you have to take a product for it to work. So I think we need to move away from the statement that PrEP doesn't work for women. There's no science that shows that statement has any scientific support, unless somebody else has some evidence. But I think that whatever evidence we have currently supports that PrEP works, and the problem then was adherence. Now the secondary question is that now that people know the product works, that it's efficacious, different from when you think you're in a placebo control trial, then will the adherence change amongst young women who are at risk for HIV? I think that's more of the substantial question.
Great. Nellie, thank you so much. And I think, go ahead.
No, would you like to add if there's any part of the question I hadn't responded to?
No, you did beautifully. And I want to say, for those who weren't in Vancouver, a number of evidence-based studies were presented, and as many of you will know, one of the early trials that presented out along with, and for those who, I don't know if I said it in the introduction, Nellie has been part of the Partners PrEP team that demonstrated quite compellingly PrEP's effectiveness for both men and women. I'm in Kenya and Uganda and was involved in the Partners Demonstration Project. At the same time the first Partners study reported out, the Botswana PrEP trial reported its initial findings of efficacy for both young men and women. And in Vancouver last week, they presented follow-up data from the open-label extension where they did show that women and men both had very high levels of adherence based on detectable drug levels, and they saw no infections at all in the additional period of the open-label extension. So, in addition to that, there was the ADAPT study, which was presented, that looked at different dosing strategies for men and women in different countries. And there, particularly in Southern Africa, women showed very high levels of detectable drug and adherence with daily use. I want to turn, though, also to someone who's always an added resource to these calls, but you haven't heard from yet, and that is Jim Pickett, who you all know from IRMA and from the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. Jim, you were in Vancouver too, and you know, a lot of what Nelly described is with great clarity around PrEP in women, particularly in Africa. The ADAPT study looked at both PrEP in women as well as gay men and other men who have sex with men, particularly in the United States. And then there were other data presented from additional PrEP studies amongst young men in the U.S. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, PrEP, it's not so much about men or women. It's about young people challenged with PrEP. And I wonder if you have a perspective and some thought about the U.S. particular context and what you took away from the kind of the U.S. perspective of what Nelly's describing amongst young women in Africa. Not to put you on the spot. Jim, you can hit *7 to unmute if you're still there.
Hey, Mitchell. Can you hear me now?
There you are. I can.
Great. Well, thank you for putting me on the spot. Happy to be there. And thank you for that that response, Nelly. I heard in a couple of places from very high-ranking people, well-respected people, a fair amount of dithering about PrEP and women and backing off. And I was very concerned about that. I said as much in a couple of different sessions, and people were sort of shocked that I used the word dithering. But there were leaders who were sort of pulling back, saying, oh, we don't really know, and they were bringing up voice and FemPrep and completely forgetting about purposely, it seems, forgetting about partners PrEP and TDF too. So I'm really glad to hear that from you, and certainly I'm an ally in that I want to see everyone who needs PrEP be able to have access to it and not have a lot of us standing in the way. In terms of the U.S., my perspective, so certainly there was encouraging results. So there was a PrEP demo project that was presented. It took place in three cities, in San Francisco, Washington, and Miami. And overall, you know, men, and especially men who were the most vulnerable to HIV, there was high uptake and good adherence. My big concern there is that very, very, very few, precious few gay black men were enrolled into this demo project. None of the sites had any appreciable black men at all. And to me, that's extremely upsetting because this is where, in our country, the epidemic is most acute. And if we are not reaching these folks with these new interventions that are proven to work so well, we are failing. We are failing human beings, and we are failing at a public health level. I'm a gay, white, middle-aged man. I'm happy to see white middle-aged men doing well on PrEP, but we really need to get it to people who are more vulnerable and who need it so acutely at this time. I think part of it was the project design. It was relatively passive. And since there is a fair amount of misinformation about PrEP in our country and some concerns and some historic distrust of the medical system, quite deserved distrust. We need to do more. We can't just sort of put a PrEP shingle out and expect gay black men to come. We need to be engaging with them really directly and making sure that they know about this and understand it and have any concerns allayed. The other thing that was really interesting that reported I felt like the conference was very heavy on PrEP. It was very exciting. ATN-110, Adolescent Trials Network 110, did a demonstration project in a number of cities, recruiting young gay men, 18 to the mid-20s. And, you know, the overall story is promising. Young gay men, signed up. They adhered well, overall. But the concerns here are two things. The ATN-110 had a very robust sample of young gay black men in it. Something like over 50% of the sample was gay black men. So they had a good representative of this population. However, they adhered much less well compared to young gay white men and young Latino men. They actually, from the very beginning, their adherence was lower, and they had the same intervention, and they were being reached in the same way in all the cities, and it doesn't seem like it can be explained away by education or socioeconomic status. But there are other things going on. There are other structural, sociocultural issues that are in play that are hampering young gay black men from being adherent. I wouldn't look at them and say, oh, it's your own individual behavior's fault. There's something happening here that is hampering their ability. And I think we have some ideas, but we have to get our heads around it, and we have to do better. We need to give them the support they need so they can take PrEP to a level of adherence that is effective. The other thing that I just found interesting, and then I'll shut up, about that study was for these young people, the beginning of the study was designed, they were seen every month for several months. And then at some point, I'm sorry, I don't have the study right in front of me to tell you the exact date, but it is online. Sybil Hosek presented it in one of the plenaries. All the slides are there. I've been looking at them before today. After they did these monthly visits, they then segued to quarterly visits. And they saw among all the populations, white, black, and Latino, all of their adherence dips when those study visits move from monthly to quarterly. So that tells us something really important. Quarterly visits seem to be quite fine for people who are older, but for younger people, perhaps they need to be seen physically more frequently, or there needs to be some other package of adherence, strategies, connection, communication that happens in a more ongoing way to help them stay adherent in between study visits or, you know, visits to the provider. I know that there's a study out there called EPIC that is looking at a couple of different ways to help people stay engaged, so hopefully we'll learn from that. But I think that was a really important signal that this quarterly, in the United States, we're telling people to come quarterly for HIV tests and screenings, et cetera, and that seems to be working for older folks. It does not seem to be so great for younger. There is this dip in adherence that's concerning. So those are my main takeaways.
Oh, Jim, that's so, so helpful. And I do want to just connect to a couple of things and some other questions that have come in. And back to something Nellie described, that clearly the issue of young people around PrEP is important, whether it's young black gay men in the United States or young women in East or Southern Africa. As Nellie described, before the conference, there was a day-and-a-half meeting led by UNICEF with a number of other partners looking at PrEP for young people. A report will be forthcoming, I think, in the coming weeks from UNICEF with a view to thinking about what should come next. I know there's a great question here about what's the social behavioral research agenda, and I think so often PrEP has been seen as biomedical, although with an acknowledgement that it's behavioral, and I think coming out of that adolescent meeting, a real need to articulate an explicit social behavioral agenda, and much like what Audrey said in terms of, you know, it's never one intervention, it's the combination of them. So it's a really, really important point, and I think that meeting got richer given some of the data that came out from the Adolescent Trial Network presentations, and I think that's a space to watch with great interest. I do want to turn, Richard, to you. A couple of questions have come in, you know, asking, and don't know if you can explicitly describe it, but how does this young woman in France who's been in remission for 12 years, how does her case, how is it similar or different from the Mississippi child that was reported at CROI a couple of years ago where we saw remission, but then HIV returned? Is there something about these two different cases that are connected in science that tell us here's a path forward, or are they just, is this just a discrete separate observation?
Sure, yeah. I think, I mean, there's a unifying factor in that they both suggest that early suppression of HIV with treatment can be beneficial, which is I think been seen sort of across the board. But there is an important difference in terms of how researchers think that the remission occurred. And in the Mississippi baby, what seemed to have happened is that treatment was started so rapidly after birth that there was no development of an immune response to the virus. What happened is that this reservoir of HIV that gets formed after infection and is an obstacle to a cure because it hangs around for so long. What happened in the Mississippi baby is that this reservoir of HIV was tiny. You know, it may have just been a couple of cells that had a virus in them that were lurking around, and those cells only produce virus if they get a signal that sort of wakes them up. And so what seems to have happened is that those cells were so infrequent that they were sort of at rest and not producing any virus, and they stayed that way for the whole period, the whole 27, 28 months that the child was able to remain off antiretroviral therapy. And so that means that there was no viral activity in the body whatsoever. And there was no sort of need for an immune response to the virus, that none could be detected. And so it was really very similar sort of to as if the child was uninfected. But unfortunately that there was a virus lurking, and for some, just by chance, that cell that contained virus got a signal that activated it as the virus was produced, and the viral load rebound happened, and the child had to start treatment. What's different in the French case is that there is clearly, it's not that the virus is asleep like that. There is clearly viral rebounds that were detected prior to the interruption of treatment. There was some, they can detect evidence of replicating virus at very low level on a few occasions, and they can detect immune responses to HIV. So in that case, it's an active, there's something active going on where the immune system seems to be helping suppress the virus, but the virus is definitely there and maybe even replicating to some degree. And that's an important difference because it's that active control that can sometimes over the long haul be associated with some problems, some inflammation and things like that. And so that's what makes it a little, you know, ideally the kind of remission you'd want is one like the Mississippi baby. And also it was reported in a couple of adults called the Boston patients where there's no viral activity at all. When there's control, it seems it can be a little more problematic unless that control is really strict. And so that's why a lot of the media stories have said that there's possibility of relapse, because in a lot of people the control, you can see in a kind of attrition of the immune system over time and some CD4 decline. And that actually has been seen in some of the Visconti cohort, which is early treated adults that have been in the news as well. And so that's, I don't know how well I've explained that, but that's the difference between the two that seems quite significant.
Yeah, that's terrific, Richard. And I think that one piece that will clearly come out from Vancouver is, and it's been in the conversation for many months now already, but I think Vancouver really highlighted it, the terminology, what is a cure, what is eradication, what is remission, and really being quite specific. So that was tremendously helpful. Speaking of Vancouver, I did want to turn back, Owen, I think you mentioned it briefly, and I wanted to get your sense. Just as the conference began, or just before it began, there was an effort from a number of leading researchers and advocates to put together the so-called Vancouver Consensus. For those who haven't seen VancouverConsensus.org, I know many on the line have seen it and have signed it, very much focusing on the power of antiretrovirals, both treatment and prevention. And I think it's really, really important. I would argue it's missing a couple of key elements. And I'm curious, Owen, to hear from you, both the utility of the Vancouver Consensus. We've seen them in past conferences, sometimes led by IIS, sometimes on the related to IIS. And I'm curious, as the ED of IIS, how you see these consensus statements and these calls to action around each conference, and also both for the consensus statement and looking at what was clearly an incredibly successful conference, Is there anything that you feel didn't get covered in the conference or got short shrift in the midst of all the other news and conversation?
That's a great question, Mitchell. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, perfectly.
Okay. Yeah, that is a great question. So I, you know, putting on my advocacy hat, I'm always really skeptical of declarations and consensus statements. I think what's useful about this one, you know, and this was largely led by a group of advocates, I think a mix of U.S. and global advocates who brought this to the table and kind of made this happen really quickly in the hours before the conference started. I think what's useful about this one is the broad array of people who've signed on to it and the level, you know, meaning people who themselves kind of control some of the purse strings around this. So I think that was a particularly smart move. I think sometimes in the past when we've done kind of sign-on statements that are just to get large numbers of people, they can sometimes after the conference die on the vine because they don't have an action, whereas this seems to have a natural advocacy follow-on that, hey, you signed this, so how are your portfolios, et cetera, are going to reflect this in the future. I think, you know, there's always that trade-off there. So when you get that kind of sign-on, there's always sometimes less specificity in it. But nonetheless, I think that this was a smart advocacy move to kind of plant a flag and say, okay, we all agree on where we are in it right now, right? We all agree on this goal. So let's move forward. So with this one, I think it has some real legs, and I think the folks who put it together are really savvy about how to use this to create change. I think for your second question around what's missing, I can't echo kind of Audrey's comments enough that I think some of the pieces on how hard it is to how hard it's going to be to get from where we are to where we want to be, you know, to put it kind of trite, is, and how important it is that we look at the implementation pieces of a lot of this and better understand those structural elements. I will say I think that's going to be a huge focus of Durban, particularly the prevention piece. I think, you know, I have to say with the caveat that, you know, no abstracts are in and the conference committee hasn't made any program decisions there. But I do think there's a lot of momentum there about how we make some of these prevention gains happen for young people in particular and young key populations especially. That won't be the only theme, but it's certainly something coming up big. And I don't think it factored as large in Vancouver as we'd like it to going forward.
Great. Thank you. And just to highlight something that Owen, you said, for those who don't know, both Mark Dybul, head of the Global Fund, and Debbie Birx, head of the PEPFAR program, did sign on, so there is an opportunity to hold people accountable. I will just say, as a supporter of the statement, I remain frustrated, quite frankly, that it leaves out major swaths of work beyond antiretrovirals for both treatment and prevention. I would highlight as an example voluntary medical male circumcision. And one of the things I will just say from my own perspective that as we gathered in Vancouver, it was 10 years to the day that at the third IAS pathogenesis meeting, the first data came from the Orange Farm study to show without doubt that voluntary medical male circumcision was a hugely powerful HIV prevention option. And It frankly is quite a concern, I think, that it's left out of the consensus statement, that it got very little attention at the conference. I think it's as powerful a scientific finding as we get from HPTN-052 for treatment as prevention or from the START study about starting people or offering people treatment on diagnosis. Those are critical turning points. I would argue VMMC is as well. So just to put in my plug that when we gather in Durban next year, I would hope that VMMC, its power and its potential really do get much greater prominence in the mix. I realize we're at the top of the hour, but I do want to then just segue in thinking about Durban, and I'd love just to go quickly down to all four of you to say, you know, what is, when you think ahead to headlines or word clouds from July 2016, what are you most hopeful for, excited about, or worried about when it comes to the International AIDS Conference 2016 in Durban? So perhaps I'll start with you, Richard.
That's a tough question. I think hopefully there'll be some results from some of the beginnings of kind of combination studies and cure research. You know, there hasn't been a lot of success in terms of actually reducing the reservoir yet, and so maybe there'll be something along those lines that would be good news. I think broadly neutralizing antibodies, hopefully more news on that front as well, that seem to have a lot of potential. I think the concern is obviously that we don't get sort of tension between the longer term aims of getting to a cure and the immediate needs of properly implementing all the effective options there are now, both for treatment and prevention. And so I think it's important that there's sort of unity and that they're all part of the same sort of advocacy message.
Fantastic. That's really great, Richard. Audrey.
Thanks, Warren. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I didn't press star 7. I agree it's challenging because I think we're kind of, I guess, how much can be done in a year, right? So I would like to see the dialogue. I think there has been a lot of lip service to the social behavioral sciences in the agenda, and I feel like, you know, 10 years ago you didn't hear some of the diehard biomedical folks even address the importance of context and behavioral factors, and now I think, you know, that is definitely mentioned, and yet I would like to see some projects going into the field that are meaningfully, you know, bringing on board social scientists and meaningfully addressing those factors more than just saying, yeah, this is important and we'll talk about it in counseling. So I would like to see either projects starting or some real kind of commitment to that. And I also am hopeful that through DREAMS we'll see some strong implementation science evaluations going on in different countries that really are true combination prevention for young women. And I think as somebody who really feels that structural factors are really important, you know, just seeing people offering HCT and PrEP and male circumcision, while they're all really important, I think for me, again, it's can we move the agenda forward in trying to address things like gender-based violence and empowerment? I mean, again, in our cash transfer trial where these girls were in high school and only about a third of them at any point reported having a sexual partner, 30% reported experiencing intimate partner violence during the trial. So, I mean, those numbers are staggering to me, that in such a young population where so few were actually sexually active, I mean, that, you know, equates to almost all of them experiencing intimate partner violence in their relationships. And just think if we don't meaningfully grapple with some of these issues, again, we're going to go back to having challenges of people being able to use prevention. So I'd like to see those issues addressed in a meaningful way.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Audrey. Nellie.
Let me see if I'm unmuted.
Two
things. One, I'm really looking forward to the results from the RING studies, from the RING study and from ASPIRE, so that we can actually expand the portfolio of alternatives and options for pre-exposure prophylaxis. Secondly, as excited as I am about the momentum for this intervention, in my own region, there is nowhere else where it's actually being implemented. So I'm hopeful that somehow in between, perhaps through DREAMS, that they will begin to have some conversations and some acceptance that this is a product that can make a difference to women's lives and other people at risk. I really appreciated the refocus on adolescents. And as much as the peak period for prevalence goes towards the age of 24, I've always felt strongly that if we don't intervene, you know, early, we are always just mopping the floor. So I think for real public health interventions, we cannot ignore this group. And I agree about the issue of structural interventions, but it's just that often people who live in difficult environments, it's not always easy to change it, and we should not stop our efforts in changing it. But if we can give them something that can help, I think we should, you know, sort of similar to the contraceptive pill, that a woman can covertly take it and not end up with so many babies within a very difficult environment. So we're working on both and refocusing on the young and hoping that there'll be momentum within Africa.
Fantastic. Nellie, thank you so much, and I just want to echo your great interest and hope for results, hopefully positively, coming from the two efficacy trials, of course, that you mentioned, the dapivirine ring results forthcoming early in 2016. And I would hope that we will see that quite high profile in Durban. Owen, to you, please.
Sure. I think this is repeating a little bit from before, but I think I'd love to leave the conference in Durban and feel like it really does feel like we had a large youth presence at the conference. You know, we're doing a lot of work right now to make sure there are kind of different ways for youth to access the conference, particularly in person. And I think that that's kind of the call to action there, that we have to feel like we're not just talking about youth, but there is a sizable youth contingency there. We're talking kind of people 25 and younger. So, you know, if there are folks on the call who are really engaged with youth networks or ready to kind of mobilize youth around this conference, I'd love to have a conversation with them because we're doing all that work right now.
Fantastic. Owen, thank you so much. I know a number of us have talked a lot about the road to Durban, and I know that you have been incredibly open to hearing from people and in terms of both the IAS strategy writ large as well as for the conference. And we will be scheduling a number of opportunities for our allies and partners to engage around planning for Durban. I do want to say here, though, coming out of this call, we would love to begin to collect people's hopes and aspirations. So if what you just heard from these four great colleagues, if they resonate with you or if you have other ideas, we'd love to have you send an email to avac@avac.org. Be sure in the subject to put Durban 2016 and tell us in one sentence what you're really hoping for in Durban 2016. We're interested in creating a word cloud before Durban, and we'll see how it aligns with what comes out of results from Durban. So again, any ideas, any hopes, aspirations, what you want to see in Durban, we'd love to begin to compile that now, not the days before the conference, but already a year ahead. So please do be in touch. And I think one other piece to say, just to kind of follow on what you heard, you know, there are a number of initiatives that are looking at individual interventions. And just reflecting on something that you said, Audrey, the idea of how do these different interventions connect for both treatment and for prevention. And while we won't see major results of newly designed activities in a year's time, I'd love to see in Durban that we have a robust set of large-scale programs really looking at how these elements of prevention can fit together. And to just be clear, you know, there are a number of large treatment as prevention studies in the field that were presented in Vancouver, a major HPTN pop art study, the ANRS study in KwaZulu-Natal, a major program in Botswana, as examples of major field studies to look at the impact of treatment as prevention. I'd love to see us have in Durban the presentation of projects that are in the field, perhaps not yet with answers, that are trying to answer these complicated, complex prevention research questions, not in one small demonstration study with 200 participants, but true full-scale implementation of what does combination prevention look like and how can it have impact. The one other piece that we really didn't get time to talk about, and unfortunately colleagues from WHO weren't able to join, but we'll be scheduling a follow-up webinar specifically about the testing guidelines and recommendations that were issued by WHO. They include a piece on self-testing, which is getting a lot of interest in a number of countries, and we haven't had time to talk about it on this call. But again, as we think about both 90-90-90 and really reaching treatment optimization and treatment targets, as well as thinking about scaling up PrEP, the role of accelerated innovative testing, including self-testing, is going to be key, and we'll be scheduling that probably late in August or early September, so please stay tuned for that call about HIV testing. This conversation shouldn't ever end, and it's not only about IAS 2015 in Vancouver. It's about where this field is, where are we as a global community, where do we want to be in Durban, and where do we want to be if we are truly talking seriously about ending the epidemic. And I want to thank Owen, Audrey, Nellie, and Richard for your incredible insights. Jim, thank you for letting me put you on the spot. Amazing questions coming in. Please keep them coming. And again, please do send us your thoughts at avac@avac.org. In subject, put Durban 2016, and let's figure out where we want to be and where we need to be and will be together when we gather in a year's time. Thank you all so very much, and stay tuned for the testing webinar coming up soon, and we will be following up on many of these issues in the coming weeks and months. Have great days, all.
Thanks.